Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. Today's Tuesday, April 9th. I'm your host, Stephen Overly. Gary Marcus is a cognitive scientist and serial entrepreneur. He's written 5 books, and the 6th is coming out in the fall about artificial intelligence. But he does not, and this is important, have a pet chicken named Henrietta.
That was just completely made up. There's nothing on the web to support it. I don't have a pet chicken. I don't have any pet named Henrietta.
But an AI-generated biography of Gary said otherwise.
Sometimes when it gloms those little bits of information together, they're right, and sometimes they're not. And these systems just don't know that. And we imagine them to be intelligent, but that's a false assumption.
Gary is an AI critic, and he's not shy about it. In his books and his talks, as well as his meetings with lawmakers, he's one of the tech experts pushing Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and others in Washington to pass sweeping and stringent legislation to rein in AI. Technology, as you just heard, he doesn't actually think is very smart. Gary has written a piece for Politico magazine out tomorrow, arguing what all should be included in a big AI bill. And he came on the podcast to make his case. Here's our conversation. Well, Gary, welcome to the Politico Tech Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You had testified in the Senate last May, actually, about some of the potential risks associated with generative AI, what Washington can do about it. In the kind of 10 months since that meeting with the Senate, have those fears come to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, some of the things that I warned about were speculative at the time and have already started to happen. Like this creepiest one is I remember laboring over a sentence in my speech and I said that generative AI, I forget the exact words, would be used to influence our elections and our markets. And I thought, well, that's speculative. It hasn't actually been done. Nobody's manipulated our markets yet with generative AI that I know. And it was a week later that the first time, maybe deliberate, maybe by accident, happened. Someone put out a deepfake photo of the Pentagon under attack with an explosion. And the market fell a few points very, very quickly. It didn't last long because people figured it out. But that's kind of like a proof of concept that other people who want to short the market are probably going to be able to influence it with deepfakes. You know, non-consensual deepfake porn was not really even an issue then. Now it's kind of widespread. It's been affecting high school students, Taylor Swift, and so forth. You know, many of the things we worried about are much more real now. There's a possibility that Slovakia's election flipped on the basis of a deepfake. I think everybody is rightfully terrified that, you know, 2024 elections here might be influenced, and there are elections all over the world. You know, it's clear that these tools are now being used.
We've seen new AI models coming out recently and with greater speed from folks like OpenAI, Google, Anthropic. Certainly more will be coming. I wonder if as you look at these newer models of AI that are being developed and being released, are you seeing improvements or seeing sort of features that address some of these concerns, or are there still big flaws that stand out to you?
Not really. I mean, they get a little bit better at making persuasive sounding text. Every iteration, there's actually some argument that these things are hitting a wall or that they're hitting a plateau, which I've been making for a while. And now Demis Hassabis, who runs AI at Google, just said the same thing. There's a paper that came out last night suggesting that you need exponentially more information to make linear improvements in these models, which means there's just not going to be enough data on the internet to ever make them particularly reliable. And inherently, the way that they work is they break things up into little bits and reconstruct those bits statistically. And what happens is some of the reconstructions are true, and some of them are what we've now in the field call hallucinations. So, for example, one of these systems wrote a biography of me. It said I was a distinguished cognitive scientist who had worked on AI or something like that. It was plausible or reasonable. And then it said that I owned a pet chicken named Henrietta that I drew inspiration from. That was just completely made up. There's nothing on the web to support it. I don't have a pet chicken. I don't have any pet named Henrietta. But it turns out somebody else named Gary, but with a first name Gary, different last name, illustrated a children's book named Henrietta.
With a chicken.
Or Henrietta Goes to the Market or something like that about a chicken. And so it's just glomming together little bits of information. Sometimes when it gloms those little bits of information together, they're right. And sometimes they're not. And these systems just don't know that. And we imagine them to be intelligent, but that's a false assumption. They're not really intelligent. And so they can't do some of the basic things that an intelligent being might do, like fact checking.
You know, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and his AI group in the Senate are expected to release this new report any day now, kind of outlining the findings from their own inquiry on artificial intelligence. I'm curious, in your opinion, what needs to be in there for it to have any teeth or lead to some sort of guidelines that actually creates meaningful regulation?
So that's kind of what my essay that's about to come out in Politico is about. And also, it's part of the basis of a new book called Taming Silicon Valley. And the first thing I would say is that there's no silver bullet here. There's no one regulation that you could pass that would solve the kind of set of risks that are around AI. And I'll insert, we also want to make the best use of AI that we can. But when you think about the risks, there are actually something like a dozen major risks that are reviewed in the forthcoming book. So there are risks like misinformation, we talked about, cybercrime, and so forth. And so I almost think of generative AI as like a hydra. There's like many different heads, and you're not going to be able to slay it with one regulation. So we need a bunch of different things. Here are some of the ones that I think are important. The first one I would say is transparency. So transparency comes in many different forms. So we need to have transparency, particularly about the data that these models are trained on. So what data they're trained on has influence on the political biases of these systems, on the biases in terms of things like hiring. There's just a study that suggests that these systems can be covertly racist. We really need to understand the data there. We also need to understand the data in order to understand the science of what they're doing and how to mitigate any risks. Another form of transparency is these companies are doing tests internally, but they're not necessarily revealing them to the public. So you should think like of the Ford Pinto and like, what did they know internally that maybe they weren't sharing with the rest of us? So we really need to understand that. Another thing that I talk about is we really need a national AI agency. It could be cabinet level, it could be something like FCC. Right now, the solution is to have many different agencies doing the best they can. But, you know, often their charters were written long before we thought about AI. And so I think it's a kind of clumsy and haphazard way to get things done. I think, you know, individual agencies like the FTC are doing an incredible job given what they have to work with. But I still think we probably need an AI agency. Another thing I think we need is something equivalent to what the FDA does with a new drug, which is they say you have to make the case that the benefits are going to outweigh the risks for this new drug. And if you're talking about deploying something to 100 million people, I think you need to do the same. You have to be able to make some kind of safety case. And we also need to have some kind of auditing afterwards, like, does your system actually work? This is just a few examples. There's actually a lot of things that we need. I'll mention one other very quickly. Going back to transparency, we should have transparency about what is created by generative AI and what is not. It should be a crime to impersonate somebody's voice or to make a deepfake. Right now, it's not, and probably it should be.
I take your point there. The deception is ultimately the problem in a lot of ways. You did talk about in the essay and just here now this idea of safety testing. And as I'm sure you've seen, you know, the U.S. has agreed to do some safety testing with the UK and the EU of these frontier AI models. Does that strike you as enough?
I don't think it's just the biggest models that we need testing on, is the first thing I'll say. So, for example, there was a recent study that suggested that these systems could be covertly racist. You don't need a frontier model to see that kind of behavior from one of these systems. And we should be testing all the systems that are deployed widely enough. You know, any system that is used, for example, for making job decisions, we should test and make sure that it is not covertly racist. So what do I mean by that? In this particular paper, they showed that if you spoke in African-American English as opposed to standard English, the system might, for example, suggest a harsher prison sentence or maybe give a different suggestion about a job and so forth. Mm. So they can be these very subtle things, and we need to test for them. We can't take for granted that they won't happen. They probably will happen.
And who do you trust to do that testing? Because as you said, companies do some of this testing on their own, whether or not they disclose the results. Can those sort of tests be trusted, or does it need to come from a government? Or
we have to have independent oversight. We have to have scientists who think about these things, maybe building separate companies or advising as consultants or whatever. But you know, companies should do their own, but there has to be some kind of independent oversight.
We'll be right back. One of the other points you made I thought was really fascinating, especially just this week in the news. We've seen some new federal privacy legislation introduced, but you argue there's a need for data rights, not just data privacy, but data rights.
That's right.
Can you tell me more about that?
So one concern I think we should all have right now is that these companies are snarfing up copyrighted data by everybody. And they're also going to take data from people's jobs, their work, and so forth. These companies are basically trying to take everybody's data. Justine Bateman just said it was the biggest theft in U.S. history. And I don't think she was wrong to say that.
We had her on the podcast. Yeah.
I don't think she's wrong to say that. I've also called it the Great Data Heist. I don't think I made that up, but I don't know where I got it from. It's this amazing thing. And so the most obvious victims right now are artists. They're getting their work, sometimes their special style and so forth, co-opted by these machines without any kind of compensation. All of these companies know that they're stepping on a lot of toes and they're not compensating the artists for it. It's a serious problem for artists. It's a serious problem for movie studios, for game studios. I've done some work on this showing that the generative image programs will make up copyrighted characters or trademark characters, even if you don't call for them by name. So like if you say Italian plumber, you might get Mario from Nintendo. So there's just gross violations of this. And we might wind up in a world where there are no data rights. And that's what the big companies would like. They don't want to have to pay for this stuff. But what we should demand is that they should have to license the data that they use. Jaron Lanier has gone so far as to say that everybody should be compensated anytime any of their data is used with some kind of micropayment system. And I don't think that that's a crazy idea. So you have artists, you have writers, musicians now. So there's a new piece of software called Suno that makes, you know, very good songs, but it looks very likely that it's drawing heavily on copyrighted sources where, the musicians haven't been compensated. And this is going to be broader. Like, it's not just the creative types, but eventually, like, anybody that does anything, they're trying to automate. And if you've learned some skill and some system is now drawing on that, you should be compensated in some ways.
On the digital rights question, though, I guess in some ways it feels like trying to put the cat back in the bag, because as you were saying earlier, you know, these AI systems have already been trained on such a vast volume of data. How do you disentangle that and figure out, okay, who should be compensated for what?
We have a very clear historical precedent here that I think about a lot, which is Napster, right? There was a moment when it looked like musicians were never going to be compensated for their stuff again. And, you know, in fairness, it's never been quite the same. But the solution was licensing, right? So a lot of people ran around during the Napster era saying, you know, music wants to be free. I'm not paying for anything. And fortunately, most of us are now paying for music, you know, streaming subscriptions through Apple or Spotify or something like that. We're going to see the same thing, I think, which is you have a lot of people running around pretending that fair use is going to protect them and allow them to train their models on essentially anything, allow them to produce anything. But when it comes down to the actual courts, I think fair use looks at things like, is it commercial? Is it competitive? And so forth. And I think that these companies are either going to lose the lawsuits or settle the lawsuits. They don't really have a leg to stand on. They are violating fair use. And so in the end, we will somehow see a new model, which is licensing, that will be parallel to what happened with streaming. So Apple licenses all the music that they stream to you. Spotify licenses all the music that they stream to you. OpenAI should be licensing all of the stuff that they use in their systems. And so the reasonable thing is for them to have some kind of licensing arrangement. Same with Google, et cetera. I don't mean to pick on OpenAI, but all of these companies are using enormous amounts of what appears to be copyrighted data. Transparency that I talked about before should make it a requirement that they disclose what that is, and we should have a licensing system.
Well, then brings me to my next question, which listeners will probably know. I always sort of find a way to work in questions about like liability and enforcement, because for so much of the ills that people attribute to tech to date, you know, they've managed to avoid legal liability for most, if not all of it. And so, you know, I guess one question I have is, unlike social media, you know, you say AI companies need to face legal liability for their products and for ways that they're used and abused. What exactly should that look like?
It should look like if you produce a lot of misinformation, you're responsible for that misinformation. If you produce something that tells people to go eat poisonous mushrooms and they die, you should be liable for that. I mean, there should be serious standards here so that the companies are incented to build software that actually works and doesn't spread misinformation. That's just one example. But if your product is made in a way that can easily be abused and you haven't done anything about it, we should hold you responsible. The tech industry is one of the few industries that's exempt from liability because of, in particularly, social media platforms are exempt because of Section 230,
right?
Or at least they're perceived as being exempt. We cannot carry that over to these systems that are generating their own things. So the original thinking behind Section 230 was like the phone company shouldn't be responsible if you make a phone call and, I don't know, make a death threat or, you know, do some horrible thing, right? It's not the phone company's fault. There's no way that they could build a phone system that could, you know, pick out who could say what back in those days. But that's different from having your software actually create a message that is problematic in some way. And I think a lot of people actually recognize that. Gorsuch seemed to recognize that in something he said in the Supreme Court. Lindsey Graham seemed to recognize that in discussions that he had in the Senate in January with Zuckerberg. Several of the senators seemed to recognize that, Hawley and so forth, in the discussions that they had with me last May, with me and Sam Altman and Christina Montgomery. So I think there is a recognition that, no, we don't want the tech companies to have zero responsibility, but the law written right now is very unclear. Another example is, these systems have defamed people. So they'll say something that's completely untrue. Like this person was, you know, accused of sexual harassment. There was an article about it in the Washington Post, and it didn't really happen. There is no article in the Washington Post, but the system generates that. Right now, the companies could say, well, we're not responsible for defamation because defamation has to be intentional, and our software doesn't have any intention. Like, we don't want loopholes like that.
Have outlined all of these ideas for how AI can be regulated, what kind of rules, guidelines need to be put in place. One of the other comments I saw you make was this notion that AI could still potentially fizzle out or not quite live up to some of the hype, some of the expectations that people have for it. I'm curious, you know, what's kind of the over-under that all of this talk of regulation and concerns about AI is going to just feel overblown a few years from now because it didn't live up to what we all expected?
I don't think the software is going to live up to what people are currently expecting. And in fact, I think that there's going to be there is a bubble that's going to burst. However, even the software today, which won't live up to commercial expectations, is actually pretty good for bad actors. There's an asymmetry here. So think about spam. Like 1 in 10,000 spam emails has to hit. They don't care. The spammers don't care that most of them don't. And so a business wants, you know, a customer service agent that's never going to make a mistake because the mistakes can be costly. And so there's an asymmetry in the demands. And that means that the scammers are here to stay. And that is unfortunate. It's part of why we need these rules right now. The other thing I would say is there will be better AI at some point. And this is a bit of a dress rehearsal. We need to get it right.
Well, Gary, listen, interesting insights. Appreciate you making time for us on Politico Tech.
Thanks very much for having me. This is really important. I really hope the Senate steps up and gives us the legislation that we need to protect our citizens.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overly. I'll see you back here tomorrow.